This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFTA's Board of Directors, Associate Station Manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Taylor Likens and her mom, Gina Likens, regarding Taylor's experience with and recovery from multiple sclerosis. But first, disability news for the week of December 11th, 2023. Special Olympics wants to change the use of language that they say has been turned against people with disabilities. Their new effort is called Yeah, I Am Special and was launched with a pair of New York City billboards and a video voiced by ESPN commentator Stephen Smith. The group is also plugging appearances by celebrity supporters like Milwaukee Bucks player Damian Lillard and former NFL player Dale Moss. The purpose is to launch a global digital campaign planned for next year to address this stigma that's become associated with the word special and other similar language used around the world to demean people with disabilities. According to Christy Weir, Special Olympics Vice President of International Media Relations and Communications, quote, in sports, special is often used to describe once-in-a-lifetime players, epic moments of teamwork, and extraordinary acts of greatness that inspire others. Special Olympics acknowledges that there is a long-held stigma that has been applied to the word special. Professional and collegiate athletes do not face this stigma when they are described as special. Our athletes deserve that same respect, end quote. The campaign is aimed at launching a global conversation challenging the labels that society imposes on people with disabilities that will coincide with the 15th anniversary of the group's Spread the Word to End the Word campaign, which asked people to pledge not to use the word retard. The campaign will be promoted through social media and other platforms, as well as with additional celebrity endorsements and partnerships with various brands. Weir said, quote, we have the opportunity to lead by example by reclaiming the word special. We aren't allowing others to define who we are and what our athletes can do. We are leading the conversation on how words matter, end quote. With recent studies, researchers at the University of California at San Francisco have mapped the autism spectrum disorder in detail, pointing toward possible therapies for some patients who have specific genetic mutations. According to one of the study's authors, Matthew State, a UCSF child psychiatrist and geneticist, quote, this opens up kind of a Goldilocks of potential treatment targets. It's an opportunity for shots on goal that we just have not had before because of the complexity of autism, end quote. The results are unique for several reasons. It's the first time that the workings of a neuropsychiatric disorder like ASD have been explored on a cellular level, opening a door for similar investigations of other neuropsychiatric disorders like attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, and schizophrenia. The study also combined some new technologies in an original way. Those technologies include stem cells, CRISPR-based genetic tools, and AlphaFold 2, the Google AI that predicts the behavior of proteins. The researchers also utilized a system originally developed at UCSF to study viruses, including the coronavirus. That system is able to create comprehensive maps of proteins that are produced by genes to carry out work in the cell. Over the past 10 years, scientists, including those at UCSF, have discovered more than 100 mutated genes that are connected to autism. But translating that new knowledge into therapies has been challenging. The UCSF-led team took a different approach, focusing on the proteins manufactured by those genes and mapping out their interactions with each other. As a result, researchers found 1,000 proteins and more than 1,800 interactions, about about 90% of the interactions are things never seen before, possibly leading to new drugs for patients in the future. And finally, the federal Supreme Court decided last week to dismiss a case known as Atchison Hotels LLC versus Loffer. The case originated when Deborah Loffer, a Florida resident with a vision impairment, sued Atchison Hotels, saying that the website of one hotel in Wells, Maine, failed to provide sufficient information about disability accommodations as required under the ADA. Loffer is one of several people with disabilities who have taken on the role of an ADA tester in recent years. Testers actively look for ADA violations in order to sue. Loffer has filed more than 600 federal lawsuits since 2018 against hotel owners and operators, similar to the case against Atchison Hotels. A lower court initially dismissed Loffer's suit, finding that she was not injured because she didn't plan to visit the inn. The decision was then overturned by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, which found that, quote, Loffer's feelings of frustration, humiliation, and second-class citizenry were downstream consequences and adverse effects of the informational injury she experienced, end quote. With increasing numbers of cases from testers like Loffer, courts throughout the country have split on the issue of standing. The Supreme Court intended to set a national standard when it agreed to hear the arguments in the case. However, Loffer dropped all of her pending lawsuits, including the one against Atchison, when her attorney was disciplined by a lower court. Some groups, including the Chamber of Commerce, the American Hotel and Lodging Association, and the Retail Litigation Center, argue that testers are taking advantage of small businesses, but disability advocates said that more than 30 years after the passage of ADA, testers are necessary to ensure that businesses are fulfilling their obligations under the law. According to Shirley Wachschlag, Senior Director of Legal Advocacy and General Counsel for the ARC, quote, despite the ADA's promise to create equal access, insufficient oversight and enforcement means that businesses frequently ignore the civil rights of disabled people, making their daily lives extremely difficult and undermining the rights guaranteed by the law. ADA testers are essential to ensure the rights of people with disabilities, that they are enforced and protected, and that the full promise of the ADA is realized, end quote. And that's the news for this week. You are tuned to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I'm Vicki Nicewander. I'm joined today by two guests on the phone. First of all, I want to introduce Taylor Likens, a young woman who has experienced MS and seems to be doing quite well with it these days. And Taylor, I'll talk to you in a moment. Also, your mom, Gina, is on because, as I understand, Taylor, you were pretty young when all this started for you. Is that correct?
Yes, I was actually 17 years old when I was diagnosed with severe relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis. So quite young.
Yes, quite young. So Gina, why don't you kind of start then and tell us a little bit about the diagnosis and what Taylor experienced during that early period of time.
Okay, sure. I think for those people who don't know what MS is, it might be a good place to start.
Absolutely.
The body, it's an autoimmune disorder, first of all, in which the body attacks itself, so to speak. Mm-hmm. In particular, there's a covering around the nerves in the body, and that's called myelin. And this myelin sheath is what is being destroyed during MS, an episode of MS. Mm-hmm. Taylor called it relapsing remitting, and that's exactly what it is, where
you'll have times where, you know, there's symptoms and, you know, and then the next day they might be different symptoms. And then with high doses of steroids, they can be gone for a while. So it comes and it goes, which is one reason people don't always get diagnosed right away. In Taylor's world, she actually started having symptoms when probably when she was 16. Mm-hmm. And you know how high school girls are, and they wear those, you know, high heels. And Taylor is, we call it vertically challenged. We're a family of short people. Mm-hmm. And so she liked wearing these big high heels. And the nurse in me, when she told me she was having some numbness of her toes, was, well, why don't you try wearing flats for a while? You know, those heels, you're probably just putting pressure on your toes. And she did, and she said that she thought that helped a little bit. So we kind of rode along there. And then one night, she had an episode of double vision while we were watching TV. And so I made an appointment with her at one of the optometrists. And they said, oh, well, she has two different prescriptions, one in one eye, one in the other. And it's probably, you know, fighting with each other, causing her to have some double vision.
Yeah. Gina, I don't know using your handset or if you have earbuds or what, but you're fading out on us. And I want
I do have earbuds. Do you want me to turn those off?
Yeah, it might not be a bad idea. I don't think they're working quite so well. So while you're doing that, why don't we talk a little bit to Taylor? Taylor, what is the first memory that you have of your experience? What are the things that you recall as being indicators that there was something really wrong?
Yeah, so I was in high school, and I pride myself with having wonderful grades, but I was trying to study so much for my exams in high school. And I just could not stay awake in the evenings. I was so exhausted. I'd be tired in the morning when I woke up, tired when I went to bed. Like I said, the numb feet was another thing where, or numb toes was another thing where I couldn't feel my toes. I was like, that's really weird.
Mm-hmm.
When I look back, there were so many little things that indicated maybe something's going on. I had trouble walking a straight line. I said, well, maybe I just am not coordinated. And so I thought maybe that's just me where I can't walk a straight line. So there are a bunch of small things that indicated something wasn't quite right. But like I said, you can write off so many of these symptoms. And you can say, okay, well, maybe there's an excuse for this thing and that. But really what indicated something was severely wrong was when I was initially diagnosed, I lost vision in my left eye within 24 hours.
Oh.
I was totally blind in my left eye. And I could not see a single thing. And again, with excuses, I was assisting with gymnastics coaching at the time. And a couple of days prior to this, I had been kicked in the head by a kid who was trying to do a handstand. I was just trying to help him get up into that straight kick, and well, their leg kind of hit me in the head. And so I was like, well, maybe something got messed up when I got hit in the head with, and that affected my vision.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went in to pretty much right away to see what was going on, because that was a big indicator. Something is not quite right if I'm blind and within 24 hours.
Yeah.
So that was a big thing that made us go in to see ophthalmology at Carl, actually.
Yeah. I most people, I think, when they think about MS and that condition, that they think of people who are older who get mm-hmm. diagnosed yeah. with MS. How likely is it that young people, 16, 17 years old, or maybe even younger, get that diagnosis?
It's not something common that you see. And you have to wonder, too, is it because symptoms come and go with relapsing, remitting multiple sclerosis? Mm-hmm. You have to wonder if it's because by the time you think to go in, like, let's say a month, you say, okay, let's go in, have the kid see a doctor. Well, by then, the symptoms have resolved. Mm-hmm. So it makes you kind of wonder how many cases are not diagnosed until later in life because of that.
Right.
Because the symptoms just are sometimes there, sometimes not. But usually 20s to 30s is when you'll see people start being diagnosed with MS. Sometimes you get some people that aren't diagnosed until they're in their 40s or 50s, but when you're talking to them after they've been diagnosed, they're like, I knew something was wrong for years. We just couldn't pinpoint what was wrong with us.
Yeah, and it progresses over the years, right? You have good moments and bad moments, but overall there's a progression that doesn't result in anything good.
Yeah, correct. And so you will have people that maybe start become wheelchair bound, and like symptoms just keep getting worse and worse. And sometimes you get less resolution between those symptoms if the medications are not controlling MS quite right.
So as a mom, and I'm a mom, so I know, what reaction did you have to all this, Jean? And what was your first step then? And your background as a nurse, I'm sure, played into this as well.
At first, throw the books out the window when you're a mom. All you see is, you know, your child going through stuff. It was really kind of mind blowing because, you know, we've always had we've been fortunate to have good health, and overall Taylor had been a really healthy kid. So for her to come down with something so major, at first you're kind of in denial, like, oh, really? Really? Are you sure? But her MRI showed that she had over 50 lesions in her brain.
Wow.
And that's a lot.
Yeah.
So, and those are what that is it's just showing damage that's being done. Otherwise known as plaques, but that's the myelin sheath being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And the myelin sheath can regenerate, but the myelin is protecting the nerves. Once nerve is damaged, you're not going to get that back. Nerve does not regenerate. So
yeah.
She started on injectable medicine, and here's poor girl. She's scared to death of needles. And now she's having to learn how to give herself injections in her abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there with her, and I could do that for her. But she's a can-do kind of a person, and she did learn to do that. She overcame her fear of needles really fast, because you have to.
Mm-hmm.
But the medicine that they started her on was not controlling the symptoms. As a matter of fact, at times it just seemed like she was getting nothing but worse. And every time she would go in with, bad symptoms, the neurologist would give her 1,000 milligrams of steroid IV, like over the course of an hour. That's a lot of steroids.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. And, you know, that has its issues too. Steroids are not always kind to the body as well. So it's not a good thing to go through, but at the same time, if you don't do that, you're not going to be able to walk. You may not be able to talk. You have memory issues where Taylor would look at me and she would say, you know, I know what that red bird is actually called. I cannot remember the name.
Mm-hmm.
Things like
and
that.
As a high school student, that made fill-in-the-blank multiple choices on exams very hard.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Scary. Very scary. So we took her down to Barnes to an MS specialist, and Todd, her dad, had already started doing some research on stem cell transplants. And for me, I am a very conservative person as far as healthcare goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't up to speed on it. It was something that was still in research. Is that something you want for your child? It can be dangerous. You know, you're trying to weigh the odds. So we go to Barnes, and she wanted to put Taylor on a very dangerous medicine that could cause inadvertently a brain virus that is 100% fatal.
Oh my gosh. But that's essentially what medicine does, though, is they will treat the symptoms because they don't know how to fix it. They don't know to go to the cause.
Exactly. So we asked the MS specialist, okay, you know, there's got to be other options here. What about stem cell transplants?
And her answer was, I cannot answer to that. It's too early.
Mm.
So Taylor got started on monthly infusions to the tune of $28,000 in infusions.
Oh, my gosh.
And you have to go to Carl to get it done. It's basically like chemotherapy because it's a chemical agent being introduced into your body. And that helped some, but it still did not keep it from occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Symptoms, different symptoms. They say that MS, quote, is all in your head, because people would look at me and go, oh, Taylor's looking so much better these days. She must be doing much better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't the case. Yeah.
It wasn't the case. No. So we took her. Go ahead, Tay.
Sorry. I was going to say, I'm still, even on this medicine, I had severe headaches daily. And no matter what medicines I took, any over-the-counter medicine, any prescribed medicine to try to control headaches, it would not take care of it. I learned to live with constant headaches.
Yeah.
Plus other symptoms, too.
We talk about treating symptoms. These headaches, they put her on gabapentin to help with the headaches, a prescription medicine, which caused her to be tired. So they put her on Ritalin to give her more energy, because Ritalin used in ADD, attention deficit disorders, slows those people down. It reacts differently in the body. But for Taylor, she didn't have attention deficit disorder. She was just exhausted. She was tired from the drugs. So then they put her on Ritalin to combat that, because she was trying to be a student by that time at the U of I, living on campus in a dorm room.
Uh-huh.
And I'm the mom going, she's going to sleep through her alarm. She's never going to wake up. And, she's going to have trouble walking to class. Is she going to make it to class?
Yeah, it's got to
really
be. Scared. So when people, other people are diagnosed, everyone's individual, I'm sure, in the way that they react to the disease and the treatment. Are these pretty common treatments for MS for most people?
Yes.
Yeah. So
they usually usually will start with like what they call the ABCs. They put me on Copaxone. And then they took me to Tysabri. There are all these other medications such as Trelenia, Bedaceron, all these different medications that they will try people on. If one medicine doesn't seem to work, they'll just say, okay, let's go to the next medicine.
Yeah, so the shots that you were getting at Carl that were horribly expensive, those weren't really helpful either. So what was your next step after that?
So after that, I gave in and said, okay, well, there's another gal about Taylor's age, ironically enough, as uncommon as it is for somebody so young to be diagnosed. She was also diagnosed a few years ahead of Taylor. So she was kind of paving the way for us. She ended up going up to Northwestern, and she did have a stem cell transplant. But it took her a while to get the transplant done because she became part of the research program.
Mm-hmm.
And every 6 months, they would draw whether or not you'd be in the control arm or you get the stem cell transplant, the control arm being controlled by drugs.
Right.
But in Taylor's case, she wasn't controlled by drugs. So to put her in the research project, she would be luck of the draw whether or not she would get a stem cell transplant. This Dr. Burt is his name, up at Northwestern at the time, he had been doing stem cell transplants and research since the 1990s. And he looked at Taylor's MRI. He did a neuro test on her. And he said, I'm going to tell you this. He goes, if you had come to me on the day you were diagnosed with this MRI, I would have said, let's do a stem cell transplant as a compassion case. Meaning, not compassion, you don't have to pay.
Yeah, but and how long after this was, how long past the diagnosis were you, Taylor, at that point?
So the when we first went up to meet Dr. Burt, it was about 2.5 years after I had been diagnosed 6 months before my actual stem cell transplant happened.
Okay, so the stem cell transplant happened about how long ago?
It was on the stem cell transplant. My official date of that was on May 16th of 2016.
Okay, and so how did that work? How would it, did that help?
Yes. Yeah. So, like Mom was saying, he when we went up there, he said, "You have MS so severely." He said, "You can't really wait much longer to be in the control group or not." So he said, "I will take you on as a compassion case and do your stem cell transplant as soon as you're off of your medicine for X amount of months, and then we can get you up here for the stem cell transplant." So I initially I was set to have my stem cell transplant in March of 2016, and unfortunately I came down with sickness and I was unable to have I had pneumonia. I was unable to get the stem cell transplant done at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So we had rescheduled it, and it was set for May 16th of 2016. And Mom, do you want to talk about the process of how that occurred?
Yeah, so what we had done is once she got cleared from the pneumonia and all that, came up and they gave her chemotherapy. And that was being done to bring her immune system down to nothing,
mm-hmm.
zero. And so we were sequestered in a hotel room. She wasn't supposed to go out. She wasn't supposed to touch door handles and stuff like that. I was wiping things down with Clorox, bleach, and all kinds of things. But it was supposed to bring it down to zero. Once, it took about 10 days. Once it was at zero, I was to give her injections that would help to build up baby stem cells.
And just to let you know, we have about a minute and a half left. So,
Okay. So baby stem cells. And so we, she was hospitalized again once they had gotten those baby stem cells from her, kind of like by, it's kind of like dialysis, but mm-hmm. not. Anyway, then they give her more of the medication chemo. To bring keep it down, the chemo, and they re-infuse those baby stem cells. And what this does, it reboots her immune system.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I, ever since I've had that done.
Yeah, tell her how it worked.
Ever since I've had that done, like, the very first day, I was not eating my contacts. I was walking a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, when I was in the hospital, I just had it done. I felt back to 100%. And that was in 2016. And I've been off of all medicines and MS symptom-free ever since then. I had an MRI that rechecked everything last year. And I have no new lesions. All the current lesions that I had have shrunk in size
mm-hmm.
and have remained or remained unchanged. So
wow.
It's been absolutely amazing.
So obviously this isn't effective for everybody. Otherwise, everybody who had MS would do this, right?
There's about a 90% success rate. It's still in the final phases of approval, being pushed out, and also to get insurance approval for it. They want that FDA approval, all of that. But it does show that it's about 90% successful and all the participants that were in the study.
Wow. Well, if you could, we don't have time to go over websites and so forth now, but if you could email me a website where people could learn more about this research project, that would be great. And
Most
then they can share it with other people. So thank you so
Absolutely.
Much for joining me today, Taylor and Gina Likens. What a great resource you have offered to people. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you so much for inviting
Thank
us
you.
On.
This mm-hmm. and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your